You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm Susan Gallimore, bringing you the Jewish Arab peace song, Havainu Shalom Aleinu. We bring peace upon us. Today we'll welcome back Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who just returned from Gaza, and I'll introduce Jared Cohen, who's writing a book on Israeli human rights. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week, Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan stormed off the stage after he was cut off by the forum moderator and barred from responding to Israeli President Shimon Peres's defense of Israel's 22-day offensive in the Gaza Strip. For context and background on that story, visit Raising Sand Radio website, www.raisingsandradio.org, and listen to last week's interview with Harut Sasunian of the California Courier, who described the relationship between Turkey and Israel and some of the implications of Erdogan and Peres's disagreement. In New York, Human Rights Watch has renewed its call for the establishment of an independent international commission of inquiry into allegations of serious violations of the laws of war by Israel and Hamas during the recent fighting in Gaza, stating that it is essential to establish key facts and to recommend mechanisms for holding violators accountable and providing compensation to victims. Joe Stork, Deputy Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, said the Security Council and the Secretary General should both work to establish an independent investigation into alleged violations by both sides. Since Human Rights Watch first made this call, our on-the-ground investigations have shown that the need for such a comprehensive inquiry is all the more apparent and pressing. He continued, civilians have far and away paid the greatest price in this conflict. While the Human Rights Council has acted as if only Israel deserves criticism, the U.S. has often prevented the Security Council from acting to hold Israel accountable. These mutually reinforcing double standards have poorly served both ordinary Palestinians and Israelis alike, not to mention respect for international law. Human Rights Watch noted that Israel's refusal to allow independent journalists and human rights monitors into Gaza during the fighting makes it all the more crucial to have an investigation conducted by independent experts willing and able to interview victims and witnesses and collect physical evidence, as well as to meet with Israeli and Palestinian officials. Human Rights Watch is in Gaza investigating allegations of serious violations of the laws of war, including indiscriminate use of weapons such as heavy artillery in densely populated areas, using civilians as human shields or otherwise placing civilians at unnecessary risk, firing on or otherwise preventing ambulances and emergency medical care from reaching persons in need, firing rockets deliberately or indiscriminately into residential areas, targeting persons seeking to communicate their civilian status with white flags, and targeting presumptively civilian installations such as police stations and government offices that were not legitimate military targets. On the other hand, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert announced at the beginning of a weekly cabinet meeting that, quote, Israel will give full support to everyone who operated for it and on behalf of it. The commanders and soldiers who were sent to Gaza need to know that they are safe from various tribunals. This bill, titled Strengthening the IDF's Hand After Operation Cast Lead, was put forward by Defense Minister Ehud Barak and coordinated by the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Justice, and State Prosecutor. Let's turn now to Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who just returned from Gaza. And welcome back, Kathy Kelly, actually back to Raising Sand Radio and back to the United States, Kathy. Welcome.
Thank you, Susan.
The last time we talked with you 2 weeks ago, you were on your way to Gaza, and I'm very happy to have you with us today to tell us what you saw and found and what you learned there.
Well, Susan, I was part of a group of three that left to go to Gaza on January 7th, arriving in Cairo on January 8th. And actually, when we went, we had learned of people in Egypt who felt that they had a responsibility to try and campaign for opening the border between Egypt and Gaza, a border that had been sealed very, very tightly over the course of 16 months and even during the devastation when the Geneva Accords say that there should be a corridor opened for humanitarian relief to go in, for refugees to go out. The border was tragically most often sealed. And so that was the main purpose for going. We didn't anticipate really that we'd be allowed to enter Gaza, but then as it turned out, by persistently more or less hanging out at the border and trying to understand what the requirements were for entering, we, as we would be seeing bombs fall and plumes of smoke arising up from a neighborhood just across that border and hear constant explosions and drone airplanes flying overhead, we began to realize that two of us might in fact be able to cross into Gaza if we got a letter from the U.S. Embassy. So we doubled back to Cairo, about 5 hours distance by car, and the U.S. Embassy did give us a note saying that we were traveling on our own responsibility, that the embassy didn't have any responsibility for us entering Gaza. The note was notarized with a stamp that could be seen by the border officials as definitely something coming from the U.S. Embassy. And so with that letter, we entered Gaza on January 16th.
And you went through Rafah.
Yes, we went through the Rafah crossing. And, you know, there were times when trucks lined up at the border carrying medical relief would be allowed to go through. But even up till today, the New York Times has reported yesterday in an article by Michael Slackman that in the nearby town of Arish, there are warehouses full of materials intended to go into Gaza, very, very needed goods. And trucks are stalled as though they're in a big parking lot. The drivers of the trucks can't hold out much longer before they have to return to their various countries and, you know, get the trucks back, get back to their families. Mm-hmm. But aid is being kept out. And this, of course, is a very crucial issue. And also, just this morning, I read that the Israeli military has resumed bombing that stretch of land between Egypt and Gaza. It's sometimes called the Philadelphia Corridor. And the reason for that is because there are tunnels. And I began to understand a great deal about why there are tunnels being dug between the Egyptian side of that border. And the town of Rafah is bisected by the border, so there are people who live in Egyptian Rafah and people who live in Gazan Rafah. And the tunnels go in between those two spots, and it's the only means through which people, average ordinary people, can get very needed goods, things like parcels of food or benzene so that they can drive and use fuel to heat their homes.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point because we keep hearing that the tunnels are for arms, getting arms through there, but I've actually seen photographs of goats going through there, live goats. And so I think your point is needs to be really understood that it's the lifeline, really, for food as well.
And, I mean, people don't particularly want to be about the dehumanizing process of burrowing underground in order to be able to get needed goods. So it's a sign of desperation as well.
Right.
But there was an economic warfare waged against Gaza in the form of a state of siege, a sealing of borders that left people so desperate that they would resort to the tunnels. And, of course, the tunnel owners, you know, they make a handsome profit off of the dangers that they undergo by building the tunnels or using the tunnels. And so it drives prices upward. But what else are people going to do? You know, right now there's a tremendous need for reconstruction, but there's no allowance for cement to get in or electrical wiring or glass. And so people who have the means will scrape together whatever funds they can get, and sure, they'll start to import these needed goods, and the people on the Egyptian side can figure out what it is people need. And there are actually tunnels designated for certain goods. If you need bags of cement, you go to this tunnel, and if you need water, you go to that tunnel.
Interesting. We've heard a lot about these trucks that are laden down with medical supplies from the Israeli side.
Well, yes, I think that there is an allowance for medical relief to go in, and that certainly is needed. Now, some of the people who were very, very badly injured actually couldn't be saved by the doctors inside of Gaza, so there was an effort to get some of those patients out to hospitals in Egypt and beyond. But I think that we certainly must extend our understanding of humanitarian need in the course of this catastrophe to encompass much more than medical relief. So I hope that intense pressure will be placed on the Israeli government to stop pressuring the Egyptian government, which technically has sovereign control over that border. pressure the Israelis to stop demanding that the borders be sealed only and only opened on those occasions when the Israelis decide that some trucks can go through, and I guess they want to set up a very minute inspection process. And it's understandable. They don't want weapons to be imported through the tunnels or through overground transport by trucks, but then shouldn't the United States people be asking, what about the huge arsenal of weaponry that we've either paid for or forthright given, and the support for weaponry, such as the aviation fuel for the F-16 planes that are dropping 250-pound bombs on civilian areas of Gaza? Don't we have some responsibility? It's as though the United States doesn't have to care a hoot about whether or not there's any scrutiny to what the United States might be sending, because nations of the world are so cowed by the United States-Israeli collaboration that they don't even pay attention to what the United States has given in terms of military support annually for the Israeli military.
Yeah, Kathy, there was something really shameful, I felt, in us watching the bombing going on down there and the total lack of, seeming lack of response from the administration here.
I think that people in the streets in many U.S. cities felt that shame and did their best to turn out and hold demonstrations here in Chicago. 10 of our companions at Voices for Creative Nonviolence were inside of Senator Durbin's office and were escorted out in handcuffs because they felt that this was the time when you have to take actions, nonviolent actions, commensurate to the crimes being committed. But the, you know, even world leaders such as the Reverend Miguel de Scoto, who is now the president of the General Assembly, are probably feeling, let me also mention Richard Falk, who was sent as a United Nations special rapporteur to Gaza, and he himself was placed under arrest and exiled from Israel. I think that these world leaders are feeling the chagrin of being ignored by major elites in Washington, D.C., in London, in capitals all around the world. But that doesn't lessen our responsibility as ordinary citizens to keep clamoring for, campaigning for, an end to this obscene bombing and a much deeper understanding through education provided by world leaders about the nature of economic and military warfare waged against civilians using conventional military weapons and also the tactic of imposing a siege.
Kathy, Human Rights Watch is currently in Gaza investigating allegations of violations of the laws of war. And they have a number of violations that they're describing. One of them, indiscriminate use of weapons such as heavy artillery in densely populated areas, using civilians as human shields or otherwise placing civilians at unnecessary risk, firing on or otherwise preventing ambulances and emergency medical care from reaching persons in need, firing rockets deliberately or indiscriminately into residential areas, targeting persons seeking to communicate their civilian status with white flags, and targeting presumptively civilian installations such as police stations and government offices that were not legitimate military targets. Talk about that a little. What was your experience in there, in Gaza?
Well, when we went to Gaza City, I was surprised to see a major section of the Al-Quds Hospital charred and still smoking. That had been hit. I think people know that the United Nations Relief and Works Agency school that was being used as a shelter for families that had been made homeless when rockets and missiles were fired into their civilian area were then again shelled while they were seeking shelter inside the school. The United Nations at one point said it had to suspend its work because its own drivers of humanitarian relief trucks were being targeted and hit. In the Rafah area, this border crossing area, all of the homes just alongside that border were demolished. You couldn't see any evidence of homes having survived the wreckage. In an area called Tufa, first all of the residents were told to evacuate. Then the Israeli Defense Forces, in a land incursion, demolished, dynamited every single home. And then the bulldozers came in and uprooted all of the crops. And it happened that I was in the Shifa burn unit. It's a burn unit adjacent to the main Shifa hospital in Gaza City. And as a doctor, was really shaking with frustration as he talked about the 22 days of bombardment while world leaders looked the other way. And he said, "Look, this is worse than an earthquake." because after an earthquake, people try to help, but in this case, they're working out ways to tighten up the siege. Well, then he took a phone call from a farmer, and the farmer said that they were trying to salvage their orange crops after all of the trees and groves had been uprooted, but the farmers collecting the oranges were finding that their hands were itching when they touched the oranges, and the oranges had a foul smell, and the doctor said, I don't know what to tell them. We heard him tell the farmer, well, wash everything very, very carefully, but really we don't know all that has been used against us. And, you know, when you go into the center of Gaza City, every ministerial building that we saw was collapsed, just a heap of debris, really unusable. There's also a major prison called the Saraya Prison, and that took a direct hit, and I'm not at all sure that the prisoners inside of there had been able to escape to safety. There was one patient in the burn unit whom the doctors believed had been afflicted by white phosphorus poisoning, and they explained to us that when the burns are so deep that they go toward the muscle and the bone tissue, this is a particularly unusual type of burn that the doctors said they'd never seen before, and these were doctors with 20, 25 years of experience. And so they had sent a biopsy of one patient's tissue out to an Egyptian lab, and it came back with evidence of white phosphorus elements in that biopsy. And they also had sent two patients to Egypt whom they couldn't care for because they were so seriously injured. And those patients died in Egypt, but the autopsy showed that what was the immediate cause of death was a white phosphorus poisoning that had gone into their circulatory systems, and the liver couldn't process the white phosphorus, and so both of these patients died of cardiac arrests. I think that it's evident that the Israeli government is anxious that their soldiers could be brought before tribunals for violations of international law, and so they have assured all of their soldiers that the Israeli government will protect them if they are so accused. But it will take a very tenacious and insistent effort on the part of groups like Human Rights Watch and international lawyers to assemble the information and to keep on pressing for charges to be brought against Israel's government. And if that doesn't work, as it didn't work after the attacks on Jenin in 2002 when conventional military weaponry was used against civilian populations in the Jenin camp in the West Bank, if you know, as happened in the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, if the international courts aren't able to sift through this evidence, then that undermines the relevance of international law at all, and it really makes of the United States and Israel outlaw nations, but without any recourse of people who are made the victims of these completely illegal, immoral, and in the eyes of many, genocidal actions. Those people have no recourse because we don't have any international law system if it can just be dismissed because of the power that rests both in the Security Council and in the kind of menacing combined might of Israel and the United States in their arsenals.
And then, as you mentioned, we have the bombing again, apparently in retaliation. Secretary of State was on the news yesterday saying that Israel has a right to protect itself. Therefore, this bombing, I suppose she's saying, is legitimate.
Well, you know, Hamas has said that it has been in conflict, in fact, violent conflict, with two of the groups that claimed responsibility for killing an Israeli soldier and wounding three others. And so to establish that you have a right to defend yourself by imposing collective punishment on a strip of land where over half of the residents are children, and then to use that as the pretext for, again, bombing the area where the tunnels are located, which Israel did yesterday, I think is an escalation that will cause more and very intense desires for retaliation and revenge that may not even be under the control of Hamas. I mean, imagine these children who've been subjected to 22 days of bombing. They see the wreckage. They see their parents bereaved and shocked, and they're never going to forget this.
As a matter of fact, I've been reading a lot of the history of the birth of the State of Israel, and what's surprising to me is that the tactics really haven't changed. What's changed is the weaponry. The weaponry has become much more sophisticated against the Palestinians, but the tactics are actually the same knocking down the houses, the same, you know, scaring people out of their homes, the same tactics have just really been made much more sophisticated.
And, of course, in the Gaza Strip, you know, if people wanted to leave, where are they going to go?
Exactly.
The borders are completely sealed.
It's important to recognize also that a lot of people living in Gaza, that's not the home that they were necessarily born to. They have been pushed more and more into that zone. In fact, earlier you mentioned Arish. When I was in Israel in 1976, I went to a town called Arish, and at that time it was in Gaza. And because the whole Sinai, well, part of the Sinai was part of Israel too. And then with the agreement with the Egyptians to take back some of that land, Arish went to Egypt. Some of those Palestinian people that wanted to stay in that area would have gone to Gaza, would have stayed in Gaza.
Well, that's a very fascinating history. In fact, Arish is a working-class town that has many people who have great sympathy for the people in Gaza, and they would gather at their mosques afterward during the 22-day bombing, and you know, they wanted to demonstrate, they wanted to exercise their right to speak freely about these issues. And so the mosque was the main mosque in Arish was a site where Egyptian military attacked the people who had gathered there. And so I think there's a great deal of smoldering anger and resentment. One very, very brave campaign that's being planned in Egypt is undertaken by a group that simply calls itself To Gaza. And these are, I think, primarily young people who on February 6th plan to start walking to Gaza, and they're asking people in Jordan and in Lebanon and Syria to do the same as a sign that they want to see these borders lifted. To see the borders opened.
Kathy, I'm not sure if you caught the 60 Minutes segment this week. There was a 50-minute segment on Israel done by Bob Simon, and it took my breath away because it was the first time ever that we saw some of the reality of on the ground life for people in not necessarily in Gaza, but in the West Bank in this case. Did you manage to see that?
You know, I didn't see it, Susan, but several other people have spoken to me about it and used exactly your phrase, that it took their breath away.
And what they talked about there was the whole question that he was asking is it too late for a two-state solution? And it's like an explosion in the United States to hear this question, because so much of our attention has been directed towards the inevitability of a two-state solution. And here we are hearing on mainstream media, as we call it, that the two-state solution may no longer be an option. Can you speak to the two-state solution, the one state? Do an overview of that.
Well, I especially recommend that listeners go to the Electronic Intifada website, and there they can be in touch with the writings of Ali Abu Nema, who advanced the idea of a one-state solution some years ago at a time when it was really considered almost wacky. A very fringe idea, but I think it's moving more into mainstream consideration. You know, with the aggressive development of settlements on the part of Israel, how would any Israeli government have the strength, really, to extricate all of those settlers that they helped move into and are still helping move into areas of the West Bank? I think that increasingly, the facts on the ground establish the idea that the only way forward would be to work toward a one-state solution.
Exactly.
Now, I can imagine that, you know, again, in the powerful elite salons of D.C. and London and other capitals around the world, and certainly in Tel Aviv, people would be looking at Dimona, where Israel has a nuclear weapon capacity that includes 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons, and you can bet the United States is not going to want to say, oh, sure, that can go in the hands of one state being represented by a combination of Palestinian and Israeli leadership. Maybe unilateral nuclear disarmament would have to go along with that one-state solution.
Mm-hmm. My opinion is that the only solution left is a one-state solution, and the problem there, of course, is that it's no longer a Jewish state.
But demographically, unquestionably, the Palestinians would begin to outnumber the Israelis, and I think that's something that people in Israel are very conscious of. But, you know, the combined and shared concern of both sides is for the future of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to look at a decent future for all of the children, then I think the possibility of a one-state solution becomes more viable, because Israel will be surrounded by countries that have populations who are incensed over these repeated patterns, as you mentioned before. The pattern is always the same. The only thing that seems to change is the sophistication of the weaponry. But that's never going to win over hearts and minds. And for a country to be surrounded by hostile enemies is not a very viable future.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, how can people help? Is there a way that they can get in touch with the people that are going to be walking to the borders?
Certainly people can go to the To Gaza website, just T-O-G-A-Z-A. And on February 6th is the day that they'll begin. Here in Chicago, we're planning to do another action of what we sometimes call extra-legal lobbying, going into the offices of our Senator Durbin, asking him to take steps to demand that the Israeli government lift the restrictions in the border between Egypt and Gaza and other border crossings, that he at least start to circulate a letter urging that action. I think it's important also to recognize the work of the Middle East Children's Alliance. While I was at the border waiting to go in, Barbara Lubin and her colleague Sharon came, and they had been very persistently trying to shepherd a big humanitarian relief shipment, which did begin to move into Gaza. So I think that that's one organization that we can strongly recommend. I also think that it's good to remember that the people in the West Bank are also continuing to suffer housing demolitions and the oppressions of an occupying force. And we think very highly of the work of the Israeli Coalition Against Housing Demolition, ICAD. So if people were looking for a website that could better inform them, that's certainly one. And then there are some very brave young Israeli teenagers who've said, we are not going to go into the armed forces, and some of them have been jailed for their conscientious objection. So it's good to be aware of those efforts as well.
Yeah, we're going to have Elik Elhanan on in a week or two. He's a refuser. In fact, his sister was killed by a suicide bombing, and kind of brought him to realize what you were saying, that we simply can't go on this way. And he subsequently became a refuser. The other one that we've promoted on our show is the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. I'll make sure that that information is shared too.
And I also want to mention that the Free Gaza Movement has been steadily working along with the International Solidarity Movement. Inside of the Gaza Strip right now, the ISM members are accompanying people who are trying to go back to their homes and salvage what they can. And it's a heartbreaking thing. My friend Audrey, who is traveling with me, had gone to Tufa while I went to the Shifa Hospital. And in that small village, she said, desperately poor people were trying to just pull their clothing out from under the rubble. Mm-hmm. It's cold right now in the area, and they didn't want their children to be exposed to harsh elements. But imagine people so desperately poor that they're trying to retrieve clothing from underneath the debris and the rubble caused by these bombings.
And it's not as though we can say that we didn't know this was going on.
Well, you know, Al Jazeera gave round-the-clock coverage the entire time that I was in Gaza. The only departure from that coverage was the coverage of the inauguration here. So people all around the world have access to facts and heightened awareness. And I think that actually people in the United States are subjected to a very dangerous lack of education, lack of awareness, you might almost say ignorance, in spite of being tuned into mainstream news, which paid relatively scant attention. So I think people should be aware, but it remains the fault of the mainstream U.S. media not to have paid sufficient attention to what was happening over these 22 days of attack.
Which is why it is so mind-boggling that 60 Minutes did the piece that they did, the timing that they did. So we can only keep pushing them to continue that kind of work.
Precisely. Yeah.
Kathy, I want to thank you for being with us, and thank you for your dedication to justice in the area. That was Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who just returned from Gaza. Go to our website, www.raisingsandradio, for links to the websites of group Kathy Kelly mentioned during this segment. You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford FM 90.1. Gerard Cohen is author of Awakened, a novel about the conflict in the Middle East region, and publisher of the daily newsletter, The Occupation Report. He's currently working on a book examining Israeli human rights violations. Prior to his writing career, Gerard Cohen spent about 20 years each as a physicist, a psychologist, and an acupuncturist. Welcome, Gerard Cohen.
Nice to be here, Susan.
First, share with our listeners how you came to the work of researching human rights violations.
Well, it wasn't a matter of human rights violations. It was a matter of Israel. And it turned out to be a matter of human rights violations.
Okay, explain what you mean by that.
I was a Zionist, like most Jews in America, and had no question about Israel being a fine, upstanding country until I read a small article in the Los Angeles Times sometime in 2000. It was on an inside page. It was about 2 inches long. And it told about an Israeli soldier forcing a Palestinian man to get undressed in the street simply to embarrass him. And it blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. It didn't make sense to me. But it forced me to keep an eye out on news from Israel. And I happened to have a friend, an activist friend, who was into the Middle East. And she began by putting me on some email lists. And in about a few months, I learned more than I knew in my entire life about the problems in Israel and its human rights abuses, and they seem to be true abuses. That's what got me hooked, the matter of being caught by surprise.
And did you have to go through a period of disbelief and then anger?
I did. That's a good way of summarizing it. I was really angered, and I wanted to let everybody know what I was discovering, and people were not interested. It was very frustrating.
What do you mean they weren't interested? What did they say?
I would talk to, for example, Jews in a local congregation, and they immediately would defend Israel and say, well, that's just Arab talk, or, you know, you're a Muslim simp, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I rapidly found that we're pretty well insulated in the United States against hearing what's actually going on in the territories.
And do you think that's just bad reporting, or do you think that there's something more behind that?
Well, I knew fairly soon that American media report differently from other media, such as European media, and that they're much more Israel sympathetic and much less Arab or Muslim sympathetic. And I let it go at that. But recently, I had come across some anti-Semitic websites, and they clarified it for me. Just because it's an anti-Semitic website doesn't mean that everything that it says is a lie. Essentially, they pointed out that the major media in the United States are Jew-controlled. Now, whether or not that correlates 100% with giving Israel a clean bill of health, I'm not sure. But it increases the probability that Israel will come off smelling like a rose.
And have you noticed the same thing since this attack on Gaza?
Reading the LA Times and comparing it to my readings of the Palestinian media that I read and the Israeli media that I read, the LA Times gave unimportant details as far as I was concerned. They told what the heads of state were saying. They told where the army was going to go and so on and so forth. But there was wholesale slaughter. and they make bare mention of it. As it turns out, a minimum of 50% of that population was civilian. And it's not going to be counted as a human rights abuse. It was necessary for Israel's defense. And our politicians went along with it. And our politicians recently passed, well, in the Senate, passed a resolution in favor of Israel, supporting Israel throughout this offensive. But what about all the killings of the civilians, which every last one of which is a human rights violation according to human rights law? Nothing about that from our own Congress.
I have to say, this week 60 Minutes did quite an expose. Did you have a chance to see that?
I've seen several things. Uh-huh. May have, and I may not have.
I'll put a link on it from our website. It actually, for the first time, the mainstream media, as we call it, has exposed some of what is going on over there. It was actually quite startling because I agree with you. There's often a kind of a blackout on real detail. Now, what about this list of serious violations of the laws of war? Have you been collecting data on any of these? Indiscriminate use of weapons, civilians as human shields?
I have one chapter in my book that is devoted to international law violations. Actually, Human Rights Watch in 2001 wrote up a very thorough listing of Israeli human rights violations, and it covered a wide spectrum of different types of violations, and just about everything that Israelis do with regard to Palestinians, according to that report, is a violation. The reason I took that and made it the subject of one chapter of the book was that I found that it was very complete, and Israel continues to do all that stuff over and over.
And now, even to the point of not even trying to hold anyone accountable, there's just a blanket amnesty, it sounds
they've
like.
They've been doing anyhow. The Israeli army is given a pretty big blank check to do anything it pleases. And the only time that Israel will come down on a soldier is if he's found out. But if they beat up foreign photographers or reporters, it's not seen in the press. However, if it gets out, then the soldier responsible may get a reprimand or maybe even jail time, but he's out shortly.
The ones they really do come down pretty hard on are the refusers, those that refuse to go into the occupied territories to fight.
Yes. Well, that's counted as against the government. But the government is permissive with regard to abusing Palestinians. You can beat them up, you can kill them, oh, it was a mistake, or there were the usual excuse is there were terrorists. And the reports are skimpy, and they're believed and checked off by the commanding officers, and that's it. These are serious abuses or murders of civilians, non-combatant civilians. And if it's against a non-combatant civilian, you have to call it terrorism.
Jared Cohen, how are your friends relating to you these days since your views have changed?
I have friends who, my friends are all for me. My family practically doesn't want to talk to me or even look in my direction.
Your extended family?
My nieces, my... Yeah, both of my nieces, most of my family is now gone because they're passed away.
This is very painful for you.
You know, it used to be painful, but it's the rules of war. And I have friends who know me, who respect me, and who believe in what I believe in, and particularly because they know I'm an honest guy, and I look things over before I decide to take sides.
But you have, I'm sure, been called the usual litany of negative names, self-hating Jew, and so forth.
Yes. I go on websites, not a chat room, but a forum where you post comments. And there I'm called four-letter words that I won't repeat here regularly. Others are right on my side with me.
Well, let's go back to some of these violations here. Firing on or otherwise preventing ambulances and emergency medical care from reaching persons in need.
Yes, it's standard operating procedure. Israelis will, at the slightest hint of any problem, start firing left and right, and if ambulances want to get in there to collect the wounded, it doesn't matter whether or not they are militants or clearly civilians, such as a woman and child. They don't let them in. These people bleed to death.
I was in Bint Jebel after the Lebanon war, the last war in 2006, and I was there actually a few months later, but I interviewed people that had been in that bombardment, and that was the story we heard a lot, that the ambulances and the medical, the emergency medical teams were prevented from reaching the wounded.
There's another thing. There's an attitude of disrespect or disregard. Basically, the Palestinians, just to put it bluntly, seem to be reduced to the status of cockroaches. They happen to be in the way, and how can we get rid of them as fast as we can? And the world's looking on us, so we can't just murder them all, so how do we get rid of them? So a typical scene would be a bunch of Israelis come in at 2 a.m., come into Jenin, let's say, or Nablus, and they'll shoot the place up just to make sure that nobody is on the street. These homes are pockmarked with bullet holes. Somebody happens to get killed, well, he shouldn't have been out on the street. Once in a while, if the bullet goes up high, somebody is, like a mother is trying to take care of her child in the middle of the night, is up, she gets shot, killed. But she shouldn't have been up. Flimsy excuses.
This is Raising San Radio, and we're talking to Jared Cohen about his research for a book on human rights in Israel. In this next segment, Mr. Cohen talks about Israeli troops participating in breaking the silence. These testimonies can be found on the Internet, and I'll put a link to this site from the Raising Sand website.
Breaking the silence testimonies of soldiers from the Israeli army who feel conscience-stricken. It's playing a game. You ask a Palestinian to choose which bad thing is he going to have done to him. Either he's going to get a bullet in his knee, or he's going to get the hell beaten out of him. Which one is he going to choose? That kind of thing. The breaking the silence testimony.
Uh-huh.
There are three major booklets that are online in PDF format. One is 120 pages, one is 60 pages, one is 48 pages, and these are soldiers who are being interviewed.
They're being interviewed by independent interviewers?
Maybe some, maybe another soldier.
Uh-huh, okay.
But the point is that they're submitting to the interviews because they're feeling conscience-stricken.
Are they refusers, or are they still continuing in the IDF?
They are in the IDF,
uh-huh.
Or they were in the IDF. And they were in situations in which they dealt with Palestinians. And everything happened from beating the hell out of a Palestinian, practically leaving him dead when he was just a civilian, and they knew it, to simply shooting him. Or a typical scene that is discussed in the beating of the breaking the silence testimonies would be a bunch of guys come in about 2 a.m. and knock on the door, beat on the door, and the Palestinians already know. They open the door, they better open it, or it'll get blown down with bullets. And the whole house gets torn apart in the middle of the night. And they leave. Sometimes they will tear apart a house that is supposed to be the scene of some militant's residence or whatever, and then they leave the house totally destroyed inside, and then they get a call that it was the one down the street.
Hmm.
They have just destroyed a house. They've torn the whole place up. They've slashed all the sofas, chopped up the beds, etc.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Hamas. I mean, what we hear most often is that Israel has a right to defend itself and that Hamas needs to stop shooting these Qassam rockets into residential areas.
Well, first, it's not just Hamas. There is Hamas, there is DFLP, TRC, there's Islamic Jihad. And in the last few years, most of the rockets that were shot were probably shot by Islamic Jihad. Secondly, my thought about Hamas is that they're straight shooters. They say what they believe. They're too damn dumb to play Israel's game, which is to say, look, we of course accept the right of Israel to exist, etc., etc., etc. These people don't, because mm-hmm. they see Israel as not giving the Palestinians the right to exist.
Mm-hmm.
They say it aloud. They're not very good politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Are they right or wrong? I think they're wrong for shooting these rockets, mainly because they're getting their own people killed. These rockets barely do any harm to Israelis, except they get them nervous.
And yet the overall sentiment, at least that we've been seeing, now I happen to know that there are a lot of people in Israel that are not for the status quo currently and are trying to, you know, change things. They just are outnumbered. But after this Gaza incursion, there was a lot of interviews with ordinary Israelis who were saying, well, you know, it's going to happen again. We should have just killed them all off. Or one or two of them said, yeah, well, you know, I'm sorry to see civilians die, but they need to stop, you know, fighting us.
Well, the problem with killing them all off, there has to be, well, first of all, the people who voted for Hamas were in the hundreds of thousands or millions, okay? Secondly, the actual number in, let's say, the party or pro-Hamas who actually fight, they've got to be in the thousands or tens of thousands. And I believe they got rid of less than 100 Hamas people, although they swore that they got rid of several brigades. So, I mean, that's not getting rid of them. They didn't get rid of them. That's what they said one of the goals was. I think Olmert was more correct in that he was saying, we're not here to get rid of Hamas, we're here to stop the rocket firing. The problem is, talk to Hamas and get a deal with Hamas, and Hamas is honest, it'll try to keep the deal going. But there are a bunch of other factions that, for one reason or other, get mad and start firing rockets.
I think there was another few rockets fired today into Israel.
I think, I'm not sure if Hamas took credit for that or what. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But
whether they did or not, Hillary, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, again, said it was Hamas and that they needed to stop firing these rockets because Israel has a right to defend itself.
Yes. And everybody has the right to defend themselves. So when are they going to talk about the Palestinians?
I'm sure you've done some research into the birth of the State of Israel, 1947, 1948. A lot of new history is coming up about that time also, about how, you know, basically the civil war that was going on and then how the three different, the Palmach, the Haganah, the Irgun, and the what we call the Stern Gang, were practicing some of the same things. Of course, they didn't have the arms that they have now, but practicing some of the same tactics that you've just mentioned, going into houses, killing people.
Well, I have just finished Ilan Pappe's Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. which goes through 1947 to 1948 practically on a day-by-day basis. According to Pape's account, the Israelis walked in with the intention of ethnically cleansing the Palestinians. They wanted the entire land, or most of the land. They were given 35%. It was a bad move by the UN,
mm-hmm.
an inexperienced team that decided on who should get what. And the Ben-Gurion was essentially the boss man,
mm-hmm.
who supervised the ethnic cleansing.
We called it transfer in those days, didn't we?
Yes, we called it the transfer. It's very nice. Mm-hmm. It's truly a wonderful invention of the Zionists to always polish their language to make things sound clean. Pape's book goes from 1947 to the present, spending most of the book on 1947 and 1948. Giving a blow-by-blow account of the different villages that were wiped out. And at all times, the Jews were confident of their numbers and of their strength.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. It was merely a matter of just getting it done.
Well, also, the British were particularly inept during that period, weren't they? They pretty much, all they were concerned about was keeping their lines of communication open and getting out without having any more of their troops involved.
Essentially.
Uh-huh.
Essentially. Morality was not on their mind.
Uh-huh. I mean, it sounds like the British would like to have continued to have a relatively positive, that means colonial, relationship with the Arabs. But that wasn't really as high on the agenda as just kind of getting out of there pretty quickly.
I would say that I'm not a terrifically knowledgeable guy on the history before 2001. But after 2001, I practically lived and breathed Israel, and that's what I spent my time working on and doing and paying attention.
Well, as I say, a lot of the history that's coming out now is even called the new history, or the new historians that are actually going into the archives that have only recently been opened. Not all of them, of course, are open, but there's a new, a whole new way of looking at this among some of the academics. On the other hand, I hear quite often that it doesn't really matter what history has been bringing to light, because the Jews needed a place to stay. They needed a place after the events and of the Holocaust, and that all of the rest of it is, the way human beings are.
Well, if human beings are that way, I look at it from the standpoint of behavior mod. I think that the United States did an incredible job of nurturing every rotten habit that Israel has, and downplaying every nice habit that Israel has, and as a result, it has become the world's biggest small monster.
It's a tragedy, isn't it?
It's a tragedy. Yeah.
I mean, I've always thought that the Jewish people had something to really teach the rest of the world about being global citizens. They've managed to, live in so many different nations and adjust to that and stand up for human rights. And we've seen that particularly in the United States. And yet all of that seems to be being lost.
It certainly seems to be lost in the Zionist aspect of Israel. I'm happy to say that there are a bunch of Israelis who are human rights activists who work hard, but they are not strong enough to counter the major trend, and the major trend is a terrible disrespect of Palestinians terrible mistreatment of them, and to the point of murdering them, killing them, blowing up their homes, taking their land, always having an excuse, we're defending ourselves, or this was our land, we had a continuous presence here for the last 4,000 years, it's our land, and they happen to be on it, that kind of stuff.
I was most recently there in 2005, and I had lived there from 1975 to 1977, and I was first of all amazed at how the place had grown, and second of all, it was astonishing to see the settlements in the West Bank. I mean, we're talking like major American suburbs in an area that was supposed to be, you know, the West Bank, outside of the Green Line.
Yes. And the Green Line has been pretty well trashed, where the history books want to just do away with any mention of it. And we've got about, spread out in different settlements, about, I think, 400,000 Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
And more coming in.
Mm-hmm. And it's tremendous stress upon the natural resources of the land, too, because this is not a place that has a huge abundance of water, for example.
So they've got all the good water now. And they resell it to the Palestinians. How kind of them. What I do daily is to spend about an hour and a half downloading information from both Palestinian and Israeli sources. And I keep records of the news. And it's grown to about a gigabyte of just sheer text. And it allows me to know my subject. Everybody's going to tell me, oh, you're just a self-hating Jew, and so on. This has to do with a sense of justice.
Do you think, Jared Cohen, that Obama is going to be making any significant inroads into what's going on over there?
If he is, I don't see it happening. Every president has failed. So long as you start with Hillary Clinton's statement of today, Israel has the right to defend itself, and seeing Israel as a poor, beset nation under... attacked by terrorists, you'll never go anywhere. And I haven't seen anything coming from Obama that indicates a breakthrough in thinking.
What about his message on the Arab television?
Well, it's nice. So we already know that he is Muslim by partially by birth and so on. And that we already know that he goes to church, and that doesn't tell us much. What would tell us much is we get the same thing that every president has always said. We will bring peace to the territories. It's our concern to bring peace. Well, I'd like to hear somebody say, it's our concern to understand the true nature of this conflict so that we can bring peace. We use the Israeli words to describe the conflict. They are under siege. They have to defend themselves. They are merely defending themselves. How come they kill so many civilians? Why do they need to do that? What kind of defense is that? I mean, nobody's asking.
Jared Cohen, thank you for being with us. Last year, we interviewed United States Army Captain Paul Chappelle about a book he was writing, Will War Ever End? A Soldier's Version of Peace for the 21st Century. It became available to the public early this week, so it is hot off the press. It has a foreword by military psychologist Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, author of the classic work On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. Captain Chappelle will be with us next week for an in-depth interview, and meanwhile, he has donated a limited number of books to Mother Speak for its ambitious 2009 campaign, and you can get your copy from the Mother Speak website, www.motherspeak.org. That's one S, motherspeak.org. It'll also be available on the Raising Sand website, www.raisingsandradio.org, and the blog, raisingsandradio.blogspot.com. Be sure to tune in to Raising Sand Radio next week, February 9th, for that interview with Captain Chappelle. That's our show for today. As usual, views and opinions are those of the hosts and guests in our KZSU or Stanford University. Let's go out with the Jewish-Arab peace song, Havainu Shalom Aleinu. We bring peace upon us.